As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello, I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Business of Sport pod on The Athletic. Each week, we'll take you behind the curtain into the world of football business and other sports across the globe. Alongside me from The Athletic is football news reporter Matt Slater. And coming up today, we'll talk to Jonathan Walters, the former Premier League player who has now applied to become the new CEO of the Professional Footballers Union in England. We'll also speak to Andreas Kranich from Sport Radar, a company that works with sporting federations and leagues to fight the rise in match fixing. Welcome to the Business of Sport from The Athletic. The Champions League returns this week. There's no better time to sign up for all our unrivaled coverage at The Athletic. Until February the 25th, we're offering new subscribers a half-price annual subscription. So that's less than £1 a week for an entire year. All you have to do is go to theathletic.com/Ornstein and Chapman to sign up. Well, we're going to start the pod today by talking about sport's battle against match fixing, which would appear to be on the rise. No surprise, really. More sports coverage, more money, more ways to put a bet on. And also the vulnerability, really, of the targets involved, Matt, who are off lower level athletes who are on lower incomes.
Well, absolutely. I think you've just framed it perfectly there, that just the explosion of interest, really, in sport. The technological changes that we've talked about in the past, that there's just so much available now. There are so many things you can bet on, so many games, so many different sports. People are streaming stuff. And there's just this insatiable appetite. I mean, we're going to talk to Andreas from Sport Radar, who are one of the absolute experts and have been helping sports governing bodies and helping betting companies as well, because let's not forget, they're often the victims of match fixing in that they're legal businesses and people trying to defraud them. But, you know, there's been some massive scandals that I've reported on over the last few years. I mean, I remember a huge one in Germany involving a referee, Robert Heuser. I mean, people will, of course, remember the big scandals we've seen in Serie A back in 1980. There's another one in 2006, which saw Juventus stripped of titles and relegated. And it does feel at times though we're sort of scraping the surface in that so much of gambling is unregulated. It's almost a national sport in many countries in Asia, and we don't really know much about what's going on there. We know bits about the legal stuff, but I mean, it's always struck me as just this grey economy that you can make estimates of the size of it, but it's tricky. And the other thing that I think has always come across to me is that it's almost like this gateway crime, in that, you know, in the same way that, let's say, maybe, you know, kind of doping feels like a very sort of sporty issue, but often the gangs that are involved in doping products also sell hard drugs as well. And that's when police forces tend to get interested, and that's when you often get the busts. And it's similar, really, with match fixing, in that we're talking about organized criminality. Sport is seen as a soft touch.
Lots of
criminal organizations target sport because it's easy. But then you sort of dig into what they're doing, you find out what they're into all sorts of stuff.
Let's bring him, because this, I mean, I did a documentary 10 years ago for the BBC on Hansi Cronje, and after his death and all the spot fixing that you would call it that was in cricket, as well as match fixing, and the criminal elements to it are absolutely frightening, really. But let's talk to Andreas Kranic, Managing Director of Integrity Services for Sport Radar. Sport Radar work alongside a number of federations and leagues, including FIFA and UEFA, to help combat match fixing in football and other sports. Andreas, just tell us about your company, really, and the data that you provide, and specifically the work you do to combat match fixing.
My personal background is in football. I worked 10 years for the German Football Association and the German Bundesliga. And the reason why we are talking here today is this match fixing scandal that rocked Germany 1 year prior to the World Cup. And at this time, I was working for the German Bundesliga. And this was the time when Sportradar, the CEO of Sportradar, Carsten Köln, who was at this time, Sportradar was a much smaller company, but already had tools in place to monitor the global betting industry with regard to their odds changes. Yeah. And to simplify it also for people who are not so familiar with what is match fixing, betting, we are talking about betting-related manipulation, not sports-related manipulation. And betting-related manipulation is nothing else than insider trading on a stock exchange. Someone knows upfront the outcome, let's say, not always talking football, about a tennis match. Yeah, favorite playing in a first-round match against an outsider and deliberately losing the first set and betting on it. Very common pattern. Yeah, this is only one example from one sport. And what we are doing at the end of the day, we have a massive database which collects all odds and odds changes of all relevant bookmakers around the world, approximately 600 plus. Relevant means that they are the market leaders, that they dominate the market. So if one of these bookies is changing their odds, the others will react. Yeah, and odds changes represent nothing else than that money is coming in on a specific outcome of a match. And now the tricky part is to identify, is this odds change legitimate? You can justify it with sporting reasons. We are always trying to find a reason why an odds change is not suspicious. And we have over 7 billion odds changes a day. So you can imagine this is a massive database, and you have to automatize as much as possible. It comes a lot with artificial intelligence, machine learning. And I have a team of approximately 60 senior betting experts. When a match looks suspicious, they are looking into it. On top of this, I have a team of 13 intelligence officers coming from the world of counterterrorism, police, military defense, financial fraud, investigative journalists who are investigating the background of match fixing. So the networks, whether this is a lonely wolf, whether this is only, let's say, a small fix done by some athletes, a referee, or whether this is organized crime that you mentioned before in the background. And we are doing this on behalf of sport, but also more and more on behalf of police forces and law enforcement. Because my guys, they have one thing very different to me, they are young and hyper-digital, and they're extremely good in open source intelligence. And nowadays, in particular now, also after COVID, where a lot of our personal and professional life was shifting more into the digital space and not so much, unfortunately, into personal analog interaction, this was also one of the learnings. And this is the reason why we are talking today. Last year was a game changer. A game changer with regard to the manipulation patterns and also sports effect that we have seen. The first impact was a massive decrease because sport was gone. If sport is gone, nothing is to bet on. And then we saw sport recovering, and also the motivation and let's say the targeting of the match fixer changing. Yeah, because at the end of the day, sounds cynical, but a match fixer also lost his business. Yeah, there was nothing to bet on, nothing to fix. So they identified, hey, this COVID-19 crisis is also a big chance for us. A big chance in the way that they said, okay, now more and more sports face financial troubles. Maybe not my former colleagues from the German Bundesliga, maybe not the Premier League, maybe not the top top sport events, but everything else is, you see a lot of athletes, you see a lot of coaches, you see a lot of referees, umpires, you see a lot of even club owners who do not know how to survive the next month. And this makes them, of course, much more attractive for match fixers and much more vulnerable. And I'm not blaming them, yeah, because at the end of the day, they're also victim of this crisis. Our business, we can only monitor if we have a sports governing body who asks us to do it. Yeah. And to give you an example, and there are plenty, but this was one really struck me, basketball in Thailand. I told you, I have this massive net. We are in this industry, call it industry of match fixing and or integrity for over 15 years now. We have a massive network of informants, yeah, from the world of betting, from the world of sport, from the world of law enforcement. And we got a tip that something is going on in Thai basketball. Thai basketball is not the NBA. Yeah, they're playing a decent sport there, but therefore also the betting interest was not the biggest. And out of a sudden, and this was what you meant, Matt, we were scratching the surface. We looked into it and we identified 17 manipulated matches only in the top division of Thai basketball in last year. And we are not like, you mentioned FIFA as a partner, yeah? For FIFA on a systematic and continuous basis, we monitor the entire professional football around the world, first and second division of all FIFA member federations. So here we are spot on. But for most matches and most competitions of other sports, we are not. And therefore, your statement, Matt, that it's scratching the surface was also for us the shocking element. So half of the matches that we identified for being manipulated for betting purposes were from sports that we are not monitoring on a regular basis. And this was shocking. And also the number of matches where we supported sports to take disciplinary actions increased last year by 80%. It's crazy.
Obviously, this question comes from a slightly Western perspective because we live in the UK and you're in Germany, and therefore Thai basketball is not on my radar. But I'm guessing Thai basketball is big for the people of Thailand. But is something like Thai basketball or volleyball or whatever easier to manipulate because of less attention on it, lower paid athletes, and also because the governing bodies are not one of your partners? Is it a perfect storm of those three things?
It's a combination. So the overall corruption situation in a specific country, how is sport organized? Yeah, how good is the governance in sport? It can also differ. Yeah, not only talking Thailand, can be in Germany. One sport is excellent, has excellent governance. The other one is lousy. And of course, very important also prior to the crisis, but now due to the crisis, even more important, how good, let's say, the stakeholders of sport paid and regularly. So do they get their money? How easy is it to bring them into a financial adverse situation where they have to care for their family, but they do not know how to feed them the next months? Yeah. And this is then very easy to identify for the match fixers, because they have an eye on it. This was also one of the reasons why we now decided to do something completely crazy, that we said, okay, let's take the core of our fraud detection system, this massive database and intelligence that we provide to sport, and they have to pay us for it to at least cover our costs, and to take only the core out of it and provide it for free to all sports on the global scale from the 1st of October onwards. It's completely crazy. It's a massive invest from our side, because we said, hey, this cancer, to use this picture, it's spreading. And this is our contribution to sport and to the fight against match fixing. And there is no hidden pay model or whatsoever. This is for free. To use an analogy also for your audience to understand it a little bit better. The fraud detection system is like an alerting system that you put at your house. We say it's world-class, it's CAS approved by the Court of Arbitration for Sport in six individual cases. They used our reports to sanction players or clubs. And we say, okay, the core of it, only the alerting system, which has been proven that you put at your house to protect against a burglar or against the fire is for free for all sports. So if someone is breaking in, if there is a fire, the alarm system is on and you as a sport are alerted, not police, not someone else. So what we currently provide to our existing partners, 80 sports around the world, including FIFA that you mentioned, or WPBSA, which is also prominent in the UK, so darts and snooker. We also have rugby, a lot of good partners. It's much more than this, but the core of it, we decided to provide now for free to all sports, because this is our answer to protect sport, but also to protect our partners from the world of betting where we earn our money. And also to protect our partners from media where we earn our money. Because if this cancer is going on, as it currently is, and if it's further spreading, then too many sports will have an issue. And this match fixing industry is getting too powerful.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Just a reminder that The Athletic has a network of club-specific football podcasts. On this week's edition of our Newcastle United podcast, Pod on the Tyne, Alan Shearer joined the show to reminisce about his time playing under Kevin Keegan, who celebrated his 70th birthday this weekend.
The thing that everyone will say about Kevin Keegan, whether you speak to him now or whether you speak to him 20, 30, 40 years ago, the thing that everyone will say is how passionate he is, how enthusiastic he is, how much time he'll give people. I mean, that's never changed. That was when I went to see him when I was a 12 and 13-year-old. Sat down and signed as many autographs as he wanted. I mean, he must have been fed up with me as a kid, because I used to go to the training ground. I used to go to the ground. I was one of these kids that I used to hang around. I used to stand outside my school gates and wait for him to drive past Gosforth High Street in his Jaguar. So he must have thought I was a stalker or a pest or something. But that's what I thought of him. And he just has so much passion for football. And the biggest thing is he gets it. He gets what fans want. He gets what people want. And that's what he gave to Newcastle.
To hear the full interview with Fanboy Shearer, search for Pod on the Tyne wherever you get your podcasts. Also, if you want to read Alan's brilliant interview with Keegan from last weekend, then make sure you subscribe to The Athletic.
There's the betting industry that we're aware of, and then there's the betting industry that we guess and talk about. The backstreet gambling in India and the fact that it's illegal in many, many Asian and Middle Eastern countries, and yet we know they like to bet. How big could this be? I mean, if you've found 5,000 dodgy games in 15 years, what's your estimate? What percentage do you think you're catching?
The 5,300 you just quoted. These are matches where I put my hand into the fire that they are manipulated for betting purposes. There we are 110% sure. And I told you before that we are partner of sport, and we are not here for the next headline. We always try to find a reason why a match is not manipulated. We are the partner of sport. So if something is happening and we're telling the partner, hey, this match is fixed, we go the extra mile in the disciplinary process, speaking to police, and at the end in sport, to the CAS. Yeah. So we cannot afford any kind of false positive. So a match where we say it's manipulated and it's not. So the 5,300 you have to put into perspective with the number of matches that we are monitoring. So I told you at the beginning that we're only monitoring a fraction of the market. And also knowing that we have a category which we never communicate, what we call borderline cases. Borderline cases are where we are 90 to 100% convinced that they are manipulated for betting purposes, but which is not strong enough that we are 110, that we put, to use this picture, the hand into the fire. Yeah. So as a guesstimation, triple, quadruple, the number, minimum.
Are you specifically talking match fixing, on that number?
Betting-related match fixing, yes.
Not spot fixing?
Spot fixing is part of match fixing because you earn money. You earn money back. But it's good that you bring this up, Mark, because for us, betting-related manipulation, and this is also important for your audience, is not that you deliberately lose a match. It's much smarter. I gave you the example here from tennis.
Yes.
It could be the same in football. Yeah, football is one also, but you can use each and every sport. Give an example from football. A team which is completely involved in manipulation is fixing a match. They are in the 18th minute. They are dominating. They are strong. They are good. And they are 2-0 up. And they lose the match by 3-2 in the last 10 minutes plus injury time. And then this time, the betting market, which is based on rational expectations, is of course expecting, hey, they're following the match. They see they're dominating. It's only a question whether they score a third or fourth goal. But out of a sudden, they coordinate that they're losing.
I am shocked about the number of betting opportunities people have now.
Yeah.
Just on some of these markets that just make no sense to me. And I'm thinking, why would you bet on that? Because that is so easy to manipulate. I mean, we've talked about cricket, you know, be it they talk about the brackets, didn't they? How many runs you'd score in 10 overs or what the first throw, of course, in a football game is the notorious one. I don't even know if that market still exists because it was so easy to manipulate. So these are some of the sort of weird things that you can bet on now. But I'm just thinking, why would you do that? Because you can't believe that market is legitimate.
Usually in the past, you had 12 hours of business and that's it. These days are gone. Now you have 24/7, 365 days. And you're not competing to the next bookmaker on the high street. You're competing with someone, let's say, from South America or from Asia or from Germany. Yeah. Therefore, it's a very competitive environment. Therefore, you have to have a 24/7 offer. Otherwise, your clients will go to another bookmaker. Yeah. So very easy on a Saturday afternoon. Yeah, a lot of great football is on, other great sports are on, Olympic Games. But what's on a Monday morning, 8 o'clock?
Andreas, right, I've just opened my betting app here, right? It's 11:28 on a Wednesday morning in the UK when we're recording this. I have just clicked on, it said tennis. I have clicked on a Challenger Tour game, I think. I don't know where this is taking place. I've never heard of these two players before. I'm not even going to say who they are because I'm not throwing suspicion on them. I can put a bet on here on who's going to win the match, who's going to win the set, who's going to win the next point in the game that they are playing at the moment, in the fourth game. So who's going to win the sixth point, the seventh point. I can bet on whether who's going to win the fourth game overall. I can bet on whether the fourth game will go to deuce or not. I can bet on whether one of the players wins this fourth game to 30, whether they win it to love, whether they win it to 40, and so on and so forth. Throughout the fifth game score after 4 points, etc. Will there be a break point in the fifth game?
There are dozens of opportunities.
So there are 2 points, really. One, do we need to regulate the bookmakers to simplify their market? Because that might reduce the possibilities. Secondly, by the way, if I knew one of these two players and I knew he was going to lose the first point of the fifth game and I bunged 300 quid on it, would that register with you?
Probably yes. Yeah.
Okay.
There are chances that we are also not James Bond. We are not perfect. Yeah. It's like, I talked about this alerting system. They are smart guys who even can break in, you know it from the movies, and they are not detected. But we get a good portion of it. To answer your first question, in an ideal world, yes, this should be regulated. But as I told you, this is a global industry, and there are companies which are, for instance, in the UK, from my perspective, it's hard to say as a German guy, but you have the best regulated market in Europe. Yeah, in comparison to others. The big problematic is that as long as you're not able to regulate all bookmakers on a global scale in the same way, there will be a competitive advantage for those who are not regulated or who have a weaker regulation. Because the legitimate, let's call them the regulated ones, for instance, in England, if you prohibit that they offer these markets, the customer, whether it sits in England and Germany or wheresoever will go to this bookmakers which offer this opportunity. Prohibition never works. I have two kids, 14 and 17 years old. I do not want them to take drugs, but it's not a comparison betting drug, but prohibition never works. It only creates black markets and mafia structures. Yeah, the only guys who really love regulation and you've seen this now after the legalization of marijuana, for instance, in some U.S. states, the mafia is suffering if there is a legalization. Yeah, it must be strong. It must come with customer protection. But the big problematic is that if you now start to do what we are doing here in Germany, the customer will move away and will go and find it's only the next good betting offer is only two clicks away. So in theory, to answer your question, yes, if there would be a global regulation, absolutely. If not, please, please allow the legitimate, the visible bookmakers to also offer it, even if you do not have a good feeling for it, because these are the bookmakers. If something is happening, we can contact who are cooperating with police and law enforcement. By the way, also one interesting fact is the bookmakers, if you look into their turnover, 80%, it depends from bookmaker to bookmaker. Let's say 60 to 80, 85% is done only with three kind of bets. The win markets, home draw away, totals, and handicap. Yeah, because why? And you were right, Mark. The bookmaker is also a victim if manipulation is happening. Therefore, try to place more than £50 on such a bet. The bookmaker will not accept it. Yeah, because he is paying out the loss. So they classify this more as, let's say, as fun bets. Yeah, to stimulate or to keep the attraction. And they have to offer it because their competitors are also offering it. If you prohibit this now in the UK, the same will happen like in Germany. The people will bet with bookmakers from Finland, with bookmakers from Belgium, with bookmakers from South America, with bookmakers from Asia.
But also what I would have to say, actually, because this is a really, I mean, you talk about the sort of lack of the market in Germany and what kind of market we have here when it comes to gambling, you know, while some bookmakers would call that a fun bet, I think it's only fair that I point out for a lot of people, and myself included, actually, just looking at that, that is a very worrying bet. And if you are betting absolutely on those kind of things, you are on a very, very slippery slope.
It's not
slope
fun anymore, is it?
Oh, absolutely.
I would argue.
Yeah. No, maybe therefore it's because of my it's not my mother tongue.
No,
because it's not financially.
Yeah.
So relevant if it comes to the turnover.
Yeah.
But I'm with you. This is something from an ethical point of view. You can debate everything. Yeah. But only if it's possible to regulate the market in a proper way so that you really can guarantee customer protection, because this is what we are talking about, right?
Mm-hmm. That was absolutely fascinating, Andreas. And I would love to do more on you as these stories develop, because that was a real insight into what is going on in your work. So thank you very, very much for talking to us.
Thank you very much.
This episode is supported by season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
We're going to talk now about the PFA. That's the Professional Footballers Association, the union that looks after the professional players in the British game. Gordon Taylor is stepping down as its CEO at the end of the season after 40 years. So joining us on the pod now, someone who has applied for the role, Jonathan Walters, who's recently retired after 20 years as a professional, playing Premier League football and international football. Why have you applied for the role then, John? What's your thinking behind it?
I've been involved in the PFA since, they've helped me at various times during my career, and I was a delegate at Stoke City, and then further on to that, I was on the management committee for a number of years. And I know that a lot of good work goes on in the PFA. I know there's a lot of there's a bad press around, and a lot of that revolves around Gordon and the salary. And I'm very passionate about helping people. And I know there's a lot of strength in the union there. There's a lot of work that goes unseen, and there's a lot of good work. Yet, I feel there needs a huge push for modernisation in there. I think I've mentioned it before. We live in a world that's changing so quickly. Every year, technology changes, society changes. And today is the slowest rate of change it'll ever be in our lifetime. So we've got to keep up with that. And football's changed, society's changed, the world has changed. And I think the PFA needs to change with it and relate to players. And there's a huge number of players for me that feel disengaged. And I want to get that relatability back to the PFA and help players.
Do you feel ready to manage change?
Yes. Everyone will point to the lack of experience in certain areas. I think the modern day CEO for me has changed. Gone are the days where one person controls the whole organisation, the company. I feel as if you need to build an experienced, strong team around you. Yes, I won't know the ins and outs of the financial world. And yes, I won't know all the things that go on in education and all the ins and outs of that. But there's experienced people in there. So you have a good financial officer around you. You have good people in those positions and you manage them. And the biggest thing for me is bringing those all together, being transparent to the union as well. There's a lot of things that people don't know about. There's a lot of players that don't know what goes on. And being transparent and having that media side of it to show everyone, this is what we're doing, this is what we do, and managing it. And a huge part of it for me is being relatable to the players. And if you surround yourself with a good team and get everyone pulling in the same direction, having the right vision, I think that's the way forward for it.
John, you mentioned that the PFA has come under scrutiny. I think that would be, that's always, you know, understating things slightly, isn't it? Nearly always around the chief executive, the current chief executive, Gordon Taylor's salary. He's been there 40 years. You know, he's had many wins, done some fantastic stuff for players. We talked last week's show about the salary cap situation, which, you know, again, seems like a good one to bow out on for him. The salary is an issue. He's on about $2 million a year. I understand that it's going to be brought down to more like $500,000, which certainly sounds a lot better. Good money. But another one of the issues I just think is around just general governance. The fact that he's been there 40 years is an issue. And certainly if you look at kind of good governance structures, term limits is a key one. And having sort of balances and checks and balances. Is that part of your reform plan as well?
You know, he's, 30, 40 years Gordon was there, and even on the management committee and things like the trustees, and there needs to be elections for positions and it needs to take place. You need to set that structure in place. Now, the independent report that I'm sure will have recommendations in there will set out probably what they recommend to what should be done. And it should be done, and again, as I say, in an open and transparent way where it's not cloak and dagger, where it's not everyone knows. And ultimately, you're representing the members, so they should have a say in how it's done as well. So it should be put before the AGM, put before the delegates, players and everyone in there, and just to be transparent in how that structure is done. Because you're right in terms of the elections, and it was uncontested for so long, and people in positions that should be applying for positions. And that's... Even the side of it, of one of the big things is having diversity as well, because you look at the PFA, the membership, you know, there's one third of black members. There's a huge array of minorities, and every country is is represented somewhere. You need to have that
female players
female
as well.
Players, you need to have that representation. Obviously, Steph, who's in the I'm very friendly with, is on the managing committee, and I was speaking to her. There needs to be more female players involved in that side of it as well. There needs to be whoever we represent, that representation needs to be shown in the workings, in the staff of the PFA.
In running for this role, is there a balance between appealing internally and appealing externally to the wider market, to fans, media, or are they identical?
Ultimately, you're representing the players. So really, it's just in the players' interest. But public opinion and having that media, having those media links and being able to say, this is what we're doing, this is how we're dealing with things, that needs to happen. Because otherwise you get questions asked and it all becomes a bit of a secret, not a secret organisation, but all comes a bit cloak and dagger. No one really knows what's going on. So questions begin to get asked. Internally, there's two ways of looking at this. You don't want drastic changes within a PFA because there's a lot of good work that goes on. So I think that's a big issue. And the staff, I think there's a lot of discontent with the staff with what's going on because they know the good work, but that needs to be put out there. But in terms of relating to the players, that's huge because they're the people you're representing. So you need to have people in there that they can feel, you can have their trust. It needs to be someone that can pull everyone together and not have someone. There's a lot of nuances that go on in football as well. There's a lot of small things that people outside won't know. That's not to say you shouldn't have someone from outside and you shouldn't have that experience of the business world, of other sides of it. The key to me is having the trust of the players and having that transparency to show everyone this is how we're doing, this is how we'll work.
You know, I speak to PFA quite regularly about the work they're doing. You're absolutely right. We should absolutely state this, that it does a remarkable amount. Be it around, you know, online abuse, be it around, you know, it's just starting to get into kind of concussion and dementia research, you know, perhaps a little bit late, but it's there now. It's done wonderful stuff in terms of just the old-fashioned injuries, knees, hips, you know, putting anything in from, I don't know, handrails so old players can get upstairs and just going into people's houses and just making, you know, their lives easier. So that work has been going on behind the scenes forever, and they do a great job at that. One thing that I often find hard to work out is how the typical player engages with its union. Do players know what the PFA can do for them?
This is the huge problem for me. I feel lower down the pyramid, a lot of players know a lot more because I think, say, League One and League Two, for example, there are a lot of players that know they'll need to re-educate themselves and go into that second career. How you get up? And people will question how it's funded and how this is all done because they'll always look at that 1% or 2% of players in and that will never have to work again. So the higher I've got up, the more I've noticed that people don't know what the PFA do. People in the changing rooms don't know. Foreign players will come in and don't know. And that's where there needs to be a huge shift in how the PFA works because you're going, what have we got, 4,000 members, more, 50,000 ex-members. You're looking at scholars. We could go into everything. You can look at all the scholars and all the way up. But if we touch upon the Premier League changing room, for example, there's a lot of those foreign players will come in and won't have a clue what they can do with. But there's that much help. There's so much help there for them if they want to go and re-educate themselves. And everyone who was a member in that dressing room and finishes and 10 years later, the PFA will still fund you towards your education, will still help you towards operations, will still help you with well-being, will still help with all these things, but they don't know it's there. So for me, one of the big things is every single player that comes into the leagues, whether it be a youth team scholar, whether it be a player that coming from non-league, coming into football, whether it be a foreign player, everyone should have some sort of pack that welcomes them and have a person accountable for them that goes in and explains exactly what the PFA can do. And to get that, I think you need that trust as well within the changing room. So every team, for me, should have one person, or every club should have one person accountable for them. Because there's always there's two or three visits a year where you sign your player of the year, you get your boot voucher. There's not enough visits, so you need someone. And for me, it should be ex-players that have just come out the game. You'll find it'll help in so many different areas. A voice of 4,000 people or 50,000 ex-members is much stronger than a voice of one. And if you look at the amazing work like Marcus Rashford, Raheem Sterling, Jordan Henderson have done on the back of one voice. How strong could 4,000 voices be making that difference to social media, making that difference to online abuse, making that difference to society as well? Because people revere footballers and hold them in a higher regard.
You get a boot voucher, do you, every year? I mean, that day yeah, my ears picked that. Up of that. Do you?
Look, it's more for, scholars as well.
Right.
Scholars and every team working all the way. I'm not too sure in the Premier League now. I think that's worth £600,000 or £700,000 a year.
Right.
Altogether.
Yeah.
Because not everyone's on the same wage. There's a lot of scholars that are next to nothing coming into the game. There's a lot of League One, League Two, and it really helps. And it just goes, it used to be given boots, but now it's a boot voucher and you go online and you buy your boots.
But that's a really good example of something that nobody would know. I doubt. Nobody would know of the help that's being given.
Here's another one for you. So the subs for players are £150 a year. The majority of funding comes from the collective bargaining agreement with the Premier League, the FA, Football League. To get the benefits each player gets, I'm thinking it'll cost £15,000-£20,000 a year per player. That can't be afforded all the way through the pyramid. Yes, you could have the top Premier League teams players paying that, but they wouldn't. So you're looking after so many people that... So for that £150, that's £20 for a scholar, it's £20 joining fee for a scholar. For that, you immediately get over £6,000 in your pension per year. So per year you're involved, £6,000 in the pension, which you can't draw till you're 55. It used to be 35, it's 55 now. And there's all help you get along with it. Now you talk about the NUJ, and I've talked to chartered accountants, I've talked to physios in clubs. What do you get off your union? The press view of the PFA is they don't do a lot and
yeah,
you're taken back. And then I went into the physios and said, what do you get? What happens? And he's so, well, I get a phone number and I've tried to call them, they haven't helped. I said, well, this is what the PFA does. You get £6,000 in your pension. You have I've written a list down here. You have your pension, you have your benevolent fund, you have your education, accident fund, insurance, medical, welfare. You have contract help, you have counselling, you have training, you have legal advice. They've helped with the COVID testing. The EFL insurance has a boost for all scholars, the Women's League, the EFL players, and you have youth development funded. And all that's off your £150 a year. But people don't know that.
PFA are paying for, is it level one and level two coaching badges?
They help with the coaching badges.
How high does that go?
They help with the coaching badges. Level one, level two, B license, A license. You do your coaching badge, you show them you've done it, they'll give you the money for it. You pay for it, they'll give you the money back for it. Education, they'll pay for your degree. They'll help you fund a huge part of it, depending on what age you're at, depending on what tier you're in. And help with the courses as well, because not everyone can afford a laptop, not everyone can afford different bits. You'll help with that. And one of the massive things for me was being involved in that management committee. There was thousands upon thousands of hardship funds, operation needed help, well-being, families that needed help. And there was lists and lists and pages of really small print of these they do every single year and they help people with. But they don't publicise that. But for me, that was a huge issue when they were taking the flak they were taking. There was no publication of what actually they do and how many degrees do you fund? How many coaching badges do you help with? How many operations do you pay for? How many benevolent funds? How many families do you help? There's all these things that should be out there for everyone to know that they do. So when I say the PFA doesn't need drastic change, all these systems are already in place, just needs modernising, and it needs someone that can pull the whole union and have that positive impact across the board. The youth team players, there was an article 3 weeks ago in a magazine, and it was what happens to the 99.988% of players that don't make it, that are in academies, not that are trying to be in academies, that are in academies that don't make it. What happens to the scholars? And I've been involved coaching at Stoke City, so I've seen this firsthand. And you'll have so many players that there'll be a pathway for a certain amount of players. And there'll be a lot of players that are seen as they don't have as good as a chance as these few players. And realistically, how many players do you get from an age group? You're lucky if you get one in three age groups to make it in that first team. What happens to all those other players? So you've been a scholar. Who's going to look after your education? Now, the clubs do good work. But for a lifetime, the PFA will always help you. once you're a member, you'll always be helped. And it needs to be, it's a hidden part of football that people don't see. And it needs to be a huge help for them and their families in that area as well.
And that was actually going to be my point. So at what age can you join the PFA? Because you talk about that important work for scholars. And is it, I don't know, is it 16? Is it 18? I don't
know. I think it's once you're a scholar at a club. So once you leave school, so year 11, you leave school, you go straight into there. Once you're a scholar, and I think it's £20 fee and £20 membership, you're a member of the PFA and they will always look after you.
The key is integration and consultation, isn't it, John? That's what you're talking about.
And trust. And to have that, you need to have the trust as well of the players. You need to have people that trust you.
The pod last week, Matt, the whole thing with the PFA and the salary cap last week was that they claimed that they hadn't been consulted over it. And that is where you look at the game at the moment, and half the time, and this just comes from the media and from being in the media, but also talking to people, you just say, for crying out loud, why don't you all just talk to each other and sort it out?
You need to have good relations with all the stakeholders of the game. You need to have those relationships. But then again, the Premier League chief executive has changed quite a lot over the past few years. There's problems with recruiting for that. The EFL have had problems. So you do have crossover, but there needs to be good relations, because ultimately, if we look at it, all everyone's employment, or media, or clubs, everything revolves around the players. Whether people like it or not, they're the sort of the modern day gladiators, where they're the entertainment.
Oh, yeah, the stars.
They're the stars of the show. Everything revolves about you. Learn that as a coach as well. Everything revolves around the players. They're the most important part of the jigsaw. So ultimately, you've got to look after the welfare of the players. It's such a short career, and you need to do it.
I think Gordon Taylor's been good at that. Kind of, if there's an achievement from his career, it's that he has, I think, established that principle that the players are the stars of the show and they deserve to be, remunerated for that. And it's kind of a North American idea, this sort of whole idea, how the owners and the players are constantly in balance. And you've always just got to remember that I watch not because the owner, I watch because of the players. I want to be entertained. But John, I think you made an interesting point earlier when you talked about the voice. And we've been talking over the last few weeks about a couple of big issues. I think a two-part question to this. One is around social media, the abuse we've seen there. What could the players do? I'm wondering if we're getting close to the point where we start talking about another boycott. I know there was one last year, was it? Maybe the season before, I can't remember. Could the players step away for a day, 2 days, just to say to the social media companies, we're not having it? And then I think the other one is you might not have seen it. One of our colleagues, Adam Crafton, wrote a fantastic piece about Justin Fashanu, gay footballers of today. We have them in the women's game, but where are they in the men's game? What could the PFA do to give those players, when they want to, totally up to them, that confidence that they're going to be supported by the game?
All these things cross over. The social media abuse is probably a huge deterrent, because you see it in everything, and it's sectarian abuse, which you saw with James McLean recently, the death threat of burning his house down with his children. It's horrendous. Anthony Martial getting abused again, more players abused again, homophobic abuse, anti-Semitic abuse. Let's not dress it up, it's all abuse, and people need to be held accountable for it. You saw the pitiful fine someone was fined for, Ian Wright. An Irish lad was fined. First of all, the social media companies need to do something about it. I saw an article there was a company from London that identified over 2 days was 30,000 messages sent to three players, Harry Kane, I'm not too sure who the others were, Bellerin from Arsenal, and they could pull out that abuse and they could highlight it using artificial intelligence straight away. Why can't the social media companies do that? Now, I know they're saying that they're going to start making change, but it needs to happen now. It needs to, people need to be held accountable. And if that doesn't, the people running those companies should be held accountable, because no one should suffer any abuse whatsoever. And when you're talking about players coming off, I think players, clubs, everything, it should be more than a day. There should be a huge voice here. It's a powerful voice. But then on the back of that, I think there should be accountability. The social media companies can do something about it. They've got the technology and the intelligence to do something about it. Without a shadow of a doubt, they've got it. So it needs to be done. And the powers that be need to punish people for it and show, and again, being transparent, show we are doing this. This is what's been handed down to him. This is what sentence has been handed down to him. And show everyone you're doing. There's no good in saying, oh, we'll find that person or we're going to do it. We'll show everyone what you're doing. It's simple as that. Now, in terms of people coming out, let's say, first of all, I don't like that term because that's a personal view. That to me is like, you've got to come out as if you've got to tag yourself. And everyone has these tags. And we're in a society where everyone has to be tagged. I don't like that. Every person's the same. There's no race, colour, gender, sexual orientation. Everyone's the same. There's no one different from anyone else. But I understand that first person that will actually say in the Premier League or something, I'm gay, it'll make a big difference. But I think the social media side of it's a huge deterrent. So I think we need to tackle that. But if I've been talk my experience in dressing rooms, I've had this conversation with players. As players, no one cares. Everyone's like, why doesn't someone come out? Like, it'll be a great thing for the sport. Why doesn't someone come out? It'll be that first person, it'll be great for them. They'll have so much to sort of the players. And that's from a player that's played in League Two, League One, the Championship, Premier League, International. Every dressing room I've been in has had the same view. Why doesn't someone come out? But you can understand the abuse he might receive or the nervousness of coming out just because society as well.
I think Adam's point when we spoke on the podcast on Tuesday was a really interesting one. And he actually referenced your manifesto here, not as a criticism of you, but to highlight the LGBT community within the male game in particular, because there are openly out players within the female game. And I think his point was, how do you reach out to players from the LGBT community when they aren't publicly visible compared to obviously gender and race being visible? Because that was his point. There are obvious, you know, there will be gay male footballers, but they might want to be supported without necessarily people knowing that they are gay, because they might not be ready media-wise, publicly-wise to come out.
I go back to transparency in the union and show what departments you have. You'll have these departments for education, for well-being, for coaching. You've got Dawn Astle and Rachel Walden with Simon Barker heading a dementia side of it, which is great. But why isn't there another department? And as I said, representing your members, what's your demographic? Who do you represent in the football world? What members do you represent? So every member should be represented in some way in a department, and you should have that. You need to be out there actively as well. You need to, that goes back to having a person-peer team, and you having these places where players can go to and feel like they have that support. One of the ideas I thought about was having a place, obviously the office in Manchester and London too, trial in a place where players can go and have that complete privacy protected. Players and former members can go to, but have help on hand there, maybe in the form of a coffee shop or a gym or however you want to put it, where people have that structure that you can go and chat to other members about their experience, but have complete inclusion, complete privacy, confidentiality of it. But at the same time, in those places, there's people there that can help with an array of issues. There'll be psychologists in the building, there'll be people, and if they can't, there'll be, they know they have that trust and they have that place they can go to where it's safe, that they can be pointed in the right direction immediately, not a week down the line, not 2 weeks down the line. Because knowing from my own personal point of view, when sometimes you want to speak to someone, you might want to speak to someone now. If you don't do it the next day, you might feel, I don't want to do it now. And a week down the line. But if you have that complete trust, it wraps itself up again, all the definitions. You have that complete trust. You get among your members, they know they'll have the full support of the union. And I think that relatability goes back to being transparent, to being relatable to the union.
Thank you very much for coming on, John. Really, really appreciate it. Fascinating to talk to you. Thank you.
No, brilliant. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Good luck.
Thank you. Right.
I'm back on Tuesday with David Ornstein. Bye for now.
The Athletic.